Our ongoing national debate about schools and their performance tends to focus on just the schools. But the kids who go there don't spend their entire day within the walls of the school. They've got homes to go to, most of them. And what happens within those walls greatly affects how ready a student is to learn or even deal with being in a school environment. This is territory well known to our first guest today. Marcia Klein Pruitt is a psychologist and director of the Clinical Research Institute at Smith College in Massachusetts. She's in Eugene for a panel discussion later today at the University of Oregon Law School called What Kids Bring to School: How Educators Can Address Poverty, Domestic Violence, and Other Challenges Affecting Their Students. Marcia Klein Pruitt, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're welcome, Jeff.
A long history with this. I see that you've got both psychology and legal degrees and maintain a private counseling practice and have written several books. So a lot of time spent assessing the things that kids do bring to school, it sounds like.
That's true. I have always been interested in schools and courts as two mediums through which kids, our concern for kids about their health and their mental health can be brought to bear on their education. And if they can't get educated, then they often start life behind the eight ball.
I noticed the panel today includes Beth Stormshack from the University of Oregon Prevention Science Institute, who oddly enough was our guest yesterday. How important is it to bring issues with or to catch issues with children as they are developing?
It's extremely important for many reasons. When children, do you mean when the issues are developing or
yes,
the children are developing?
Well, both, I guess, yeah.
It's true. Well, first we have to get the kids as they're developing. The younger that we can get kids noticed and supported, the more chance we have of getting them on a trajectory that will help them be successful. In terms of the issues, I understand that schools have many things to do and that they're feeling pretty overwhelmed with all of the psychosocial needs that children and families bring to schools these days. But if we don't address those, we really don't have a chance for kids to graduate from high school and to be on an equal footing with children who don't have quite so many adverse experiences when they're young and who can really focus on education. So it's critical that we get to it young, while children's brains are still developing, while their self-esteem is developing, and so that we can help them feel good enough about themselves that they can focus on what they need to learn.
Is there an optimum age or optimum age window in which you would like to get some attention focused on kids who need it?
Optimum age would be in the first 5 years of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that's optimum.
All right. But usually by the time they're showing up in school, they're obviously five and five plus, and so you've got, sounds like some catching up to do in some cases.
A lot of catching up to do. Many people are calling for universal preschools because then there'd be less catching up to do. A lot of the work I've been doing is with middle and high school students, and by then we're doing catch-up extraordinaire. It's not too late by any means, and so one of the things that I want to make sure we message is that the sooner the better, but it's never too late, and we should never ignore an opportunity to address kids' needs in a way that supports them.
So what kinds of issues are you dealing with in the middle and high school students that you see?
One of the biggest issues that I'm dealing with in Massachusetts is children who come to school with homes that have been riddled with conflict and violence most of their lives. And the students, especially our students of color, have faced racism and oppression to such an extreme that they're unable to really focus on learning. They're much more concerned about what's happening at home or what's happening internally that has caused them to be ever on alert and to be expecting a fight every time they turn around.
So that's a constant state of readiness, it sounds like, which sounds exhausting and certainly difficult to get an education into.
Absolutely.
So what are some of the approaches then? Let's take these apart one at a time. So homes where there's conflict going on, and I noticed that you've written books about divorce, and you know, if it's appropriate for the couple to do it, you do seem to advocate that.
To share parenting, you mean, even if there's conflict at home?
Well, and to divide, you know, don't stay together for the kids. It seems to be a pretty common message here.
We know now that kids who are in high conflict homes actually do better when their parents separate. If they've tried whatever they can to reduce the conflict and it isn't going away, if they're constantly fighting, then they're busy focusing on each other, not their children. And kids actually do much better. Kids whose parents are not in such high conflict, who separate, are often surprised that their parents separate, and they have a much harder time. while kids who have seen this conflict and violence going on feel relief that there's going to be some way that they won't have to deal with it on an everyday basis. So it's a little counterintuitive, and it's a bit counterintuitive from what we have encouraged in the past.
Marcia Klein Pruitt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a psychologist and the director of the Clinical Research Institute at Smith College in Massachusetts. She'll be part of a panel discussion at 4 o'clock this afternoon at the law school at University of Oregon called What Kids Bring to School, How Educators Can Address Poverty, Domestic Violence, and Other Challenges Affecting Their Students. This is a conversation you're welcome to join on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when a child does come from a home with conflict, I mean, can those issues be dealt with in a clinical setting? Can they be dealt with just within the school? Or does it require ultimately getting into the home?
It depends on how severe the conflict is and what the school's able to do about it. Certainly schools can be helpful. One of the things that we have learned is that schools that have a strong philosophical and conceptual framework that supports the fighting of the problem that they're concerned about have kids who are doing better in school. So if we're interested in conflict, there are a number of ways that we can look at how discipline is meted out in middle schools and high schools. Is it done in a way that teaches children more about problem solving than avoidance or aggression? Are there ways that there can be set up student organizations that where students decide what to do about other student conflict? And are there ways that the school can have more extra morning time or afternoon time to help kids stay out of home and do homework before they have to go home so that they can use a structured and safe and peaceful environment to get done what they have to get done? In addition to that, any time that we can get parents some intervention, whether it's groups that the school support or whether it's clinical supervision, clinical intervention that is more one-on-one or family, that's ideal. But many families are not willing to engage in that or can't for various reasons. It may be a financial reason. It may be a personal reason. So at least in the schools, we can provide the kind of responsive and supportive parenting that we wish kids were getting at home. It's a great antidote.
For adults, it certainly seems to help to know that there are other people in the same situation. It can be or has been, and historically, it seems like a different kind of thing for kids where you really don't want to talk to anybody about the stuff that goes on at home or admit it because you carry the shame from home in with you, and certainly as kids think that you may be responsible for it. So I just wonder over the years, is there more talking in group settings in school with kids or at least acknowledgement of issues that go on at home where once they were very closely held secrets?
Absolutely. We've learned that group settings are a terrific way of having kids find out that they're not alone, that other people are going through this, that other kids can give them not only support but ideas about how to deal with things. And they have a group that they can talk to because one of the things that kids are afraid of is being ridiculed or being embarrassed or ashamed of some of the problems that they're facing at home. And when other kids are going through the same thing and talking about it, it no longer becomes shameful. It becomes supportive. And we also learn to do the same thing with parents. We have programs throughout California and Alberta, Canada, and other areas and other states that my colleagues and I have started called Supporting Father Involvement, where we help reduce family conflict and reduce couple conflict in particular so that parents can focus on parenting so that fathers can stay involved. And one of the things that parents have said, and we've done these groups with low-income families, middle-income families, we've done them in Spanish and English, we have had many different ethnic and racial groups be part of them, and everybody says that what they love most is the sense of community and that they can talk about things. And that they can talk about things that they're afraid to bring up one-on-one with their spouse that they can do in a group. So we try and parallel what kids are doing in schools and what people are doing outside of schools and what parents can do so that we can change this culture of silence and shame and make it something where we know people when they talk about it and when they work on issues with skilled facilitators, we can make a difference.
I noticed your work with SFI, the Supporting Fatherhood Involvement Initiative. And is there a parallel program for the children in addition to what the parents get?
There's not in our particular program. We work with families with younger children, and some of the research that has come out shows that if you work with the parents, and if you work with the parents and the children together, that that has a bigger bang for your buck than working with the children separately. But as children get older in middle and high schools, there are a number of school programs for children whose parents are in conflict, for children whose parents are separating, for children who have faced a kind of racism that has really seared at their hearts and their souls and given them a chance to change the story that they're growing up with about who they are and what they have to deal with.
Marcia Klein-Pruitt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, psychologist and director of the Clinical Research Institute at Smith College, coming to the University of Oregon this afternoon for a panel discussion. One of several people on the panel for What Kids Bring to School, How Educators Can Address Poverty, Domestic Violence, and Other Challenges Affecting Their Students. Very interesting topic to a lot of people. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you very much. My question, as a former high school teacher, I didn't hear as much of what was going on in these kids' lives, but my wife would hear a lot of stories, and I'm not sure exactly why that is.
That's true.
So my question is, why would elementary kids kind of like, I think maybe it's because they have conferences or something, but at the high school level, I wouldn't tend to hear that many stories of abuse, or I only heard in 30 years, I only ran across one story. I had one kid I had to, you know, turn in the parents for. So thanks.
Thank you, John. So appreciate your wife teaches elementary school, you teach high school. Okay, I see that, or did. So what is the usual run of information getting around?
A lot of it has to do with opportunity. Elementary school teachers are with their kids all day, and they are with them from the beginning of the day when they come in. They sometimes even see them get dropped off. They have more contact with families. They do learn a lot more than high school students. But we've learned that when a high school student takes the time to talk with students, and I know it's really difficult because they're moving in and out of your classroom, but if you get to know your students and talk with them, if you ask them about some of the themes that you see in their writing, if you're in a course where they're writing and tying it into personal things, kids leave clues. And with a little bit of support, they're happy to talk. But you have to make the time outside class. They really don't open up in classrooms anymore. They're just too old for that. But they're looking for people to talk to, and there are always a couple teachers in each high school who do know everything that's going on with many of the kids.
So it needs to be one-on-one, and it sounds like you need to pick your moment fairly carefully, too.
Absolutely, just like parents do. If you want your kids to open up and they're teenagers, they're not going to do it at the time that you decide is good quality time at dinner. They're going to do it as they're getting out of the car or as you tell them to go to bed. They pick their moment, and that moment is a time when there's a transition, when they're feeling a little vulnerable, and when they want something from you that they're not going to get otherwise because you're busy doing a different kind of parenting.
Marcia, when we got to the outset, we were talking about issues with conflict in the home and then also issues of racism and oppression, which we nicked a couple times. I want to get it a little more squarely. When a child is dealing with racism or oppression in their lives, what are some of the initial approaches you take?
There are a number of things that can be done at the school level. So we've learned that culturally responsive teaching methods, where teachers do engage with students and their families and where they design curricula that are relevant to students' experiences, that really is helpful. In a school that I'm going to be talking about in the panel this afternoon, a social justice charter school in Holyoke, Massachusetts, the students have a chance to design an autobiography where they talk about what they have faced and they talk about what they've learned about how they can deal with it. And so they need to learn it in order to write it. And their writing is very personal, and the students are really moved by the experience, and they come out feeling like they have some control back and some chance to rewrite their own story. But also pedagogies with strong democratic qualities, where the staff are really committed to looking at themselves and all of their class materials to notice what kind of social identities are and are not examined or presented, and what kind of biases are presented, whether it's about cultural and racial issues, whether it's about gender and gender orientation issues. Kids need to know that teachers are aware of these and that they're looking at them and that they want to work with them to be more inclusive. So when teachers do that and they facilitate cooperative learning environments where, again, students are part of the solution and they're driving their education, the students really come back and find that the racism that they've dealt with, they have a chance to master it and to rise above it and not feel like they can no longer be who they are.
I'm fascinated by the whole concept. It's a social justice high school, you say?
Yes.
Outside of the confines of that particular school, I mean, in a case where there isn't such a school available to a student, are there other programs that address how they should be dealing with racism in their lives and how they should be thinking about racism so it doesn't end up swamping their school experience and making them not good students?
Absolutely. There are curricula that teachers can implement, but I think that's difficult to do given the confines of what they have to cover. So it's more important, how does the school present itself in terms of their interest in finding out what's important to students, finding out what students are struggling with, making sure they're on top of bullying? Do they know which students are afraid? Do they know, you know, what kind of humor kids are using? There's many ways to inculcate values that are consistent with a more open and supportive environment, and you can do that in the way you teach, not just in what you teach. So any school can train their teachers to be more open and to be more positive in that way.
I noticed the rise of trauma-informed approaches in a lot of different places where we're basically talking about ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences. Is there an assumption now that pretty much every child walking into the door of a school is carrying some kind of emotional baggage?
I hope not every child, but there is an assumption that in certain places, students have had more than their share of early adverse experiences. And a trauma-informed approach says that we're going to focus on creating a well-regulated environment that is structured, that feels peaceful, where there's sensitive and responsive relationships between the adults in the school and the kids. And I'm not just talking about teachers, but the person who's at the front desk and the staff. And I have actually trained lunchroom aides and bus drivers as people who have sometimes much clearer pictures of what's going on with kids than the classroom teachers do, because they see when kids are really getting into their groups and picking on each other or joking in ways that aren't really funny. So any of those things, and also helping students develop core life skills, so that you want a model that promotes students having a chance to acknowledge and share some of the things that they have felt, to grieve their losses, to recognize the kind of self-blame that comes with internalized racism, to experience the kind of anger that comes when you've seen your parents fighting constantly and when you can no longer know when people are angry and they can settle their problems, or when they're angry and they never settle their problems. And you want to kind of cultivate these coping strategies and the chances as students get older to be social change agents, to do positive things for their schools that set a tone that say, we can do something even as kids. We don't have to just be victims.
Marcia Klein Pruitt's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, psychologist, director of the Clinical Research Institute at Smith College, speaking at a panel at the University of Oregon this afternoon, What Kids Bring to School, which includes poverty, domestic violence, and others. I wonder if some programs are designed to just sort of train all of the students early on about things to look for in their own lives, or if it's more appropriate to find them first and to give the attention to individual kids who clearly have some needs.
This has been a debate for centuries. It's the focus of prevention efforts. Do we do universal prevention, or do we do secondary prevention? Secondary prevention means targeting kids that we know are at risk, and universal prevention means let's assume that everybody might have issues that we don't know about. I think a combination of both strategies is really useful. When students are in middle school developing these even 30-minute mornings where students go to a homeroom but spend some time focusing on other kinds of psychological or social issues, that has proven to be useful in some school environments. Having a different kind of discipline system, as I've talked about before, has proven useful. So I think it's very important to say to kids, everybody can benefit from this. But then in addition, if kids are really struggling, we need to know who those kids are, and perhaps there is a different level of intervention. It depends, again, on whether the student is willing and whether the school is able to provide what the student needs in a way that is supportive rather than calling out the student and recognizing them in a way that they're even more embarrassed.
I hadn't mentioned thus far that a lot of your work is through the courts. That you do, one of your degrees is a Master of Science in Law, so you certainly understand interventions that start from the court system. And I'm just guessing those are a bit more expensive and a bit harder than programs that start earlier in life, dealing with problems before they get to the courts.
Absolutely. But that is one of my real passions. I think the courts are a place where we can make such important changes, because if we don't, I mean, in so many of our families go through the courts. They go through, maybe if they're establishing paternity, if they're establishing child support, if they're separating, if they're trying to figure out a parenting plan that allows some shared parenting. If you look at all the ways people go through the family courts, we have a tremendous opportunity that we're missing, where we just are looking away from conflict instead of dealing with it. And some of the programs in the University of Denver started a program where the separation and divorce has moved out of the court system and in the university system, and now in a community-based center where families never need to go to court, and the kids get counseling and the parents get all kinds of mediation and support.
Wow, all kinds of programs going on out there, some of which will be talked about this afternoon at the University of Oregon at 4 o'clock. What kids bring to school, how educators can address poverty, domestic violence, and other challenges affecting their students. Marcia Klein Pruitt on that panel. And thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, take it easy.